This podcast is sponsored by ORC HSE Strategies, an industry leader in developing innovative and sustainable approaches for protecting workers and the environment. ORC membership includes EH&S vice presidents, directors, and senior managers from over 120 large global corporations in 20 different industry sectors. Many member companies like General Electric and Alcoa and GM and ExxonMobil and DuPont and Duke Energy and Siemens Healthcare Diagnostics and Allergan and Procter & Gamble and 3M have very well-established reputations as industry leaders in EH&S. That's like reading the greatest hits list. The value provided by the organization comes from harnessing the collective wisdom of all of these members and from the guidance and facilitation and expertise from the staff with decades of experience in EH&S. If you're interested in learning more about the unique opportunities available through ORCHSE, please contact Linda Haney at 202-510-0509. Or you can pop Linda an email at linda.haney@orchse.com. That's Linda, L-I-N-D-A dot Haney, H-A-N-E-Y, at orchse.com. Now, the podcast. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your loving host, Fred Jones. No, Terry. No, that's no. It's Todd Conklin. I got it. I finally got it. Hey, I hope everything's going great with you. Today's podcast will be a humdinger, and who doesn't want a humdinger given the opportunity to get one? This is a great podcast because it is actually a presentation from the Human Performance Root Cause Trending Conference, starring Mark Yeston. Mark's been on the podcast before, retired National Park Service chief ranger, big in like swift water rescue, big in high angle rescue, a lot of helicopter rescue. But what he really did super well was supervised highly reliable teams in practice. And I left actually the introduction for Mark in this presentation on the front of it. It's a really good little presentation. I think you're going to enjoy it immensely. I know I did. It was really fun to watch. The visuals would be cool, but the problem with a podcast is you can't have visuals. So anytime he says spot the ranger or that's me hanging from a string on the bottom of a helicopter, it was a picture of a helicopter way up in the sky above the Grand Canyon with a little teeny speck hanging on the end of a thread. That was him. I think you'll enjoy this immensely. Mark is so good at understanding field leadership for highly performing teams. And he talks directly to it. You're going to hear some great stuff. You're definitely going to hear the language of new safety. And that's worthwhile as well. So without much more fanfare, let me shut up and put Mark Yeston on. This is his presentation 2016 at the HPRCT conference. It's all yours, Mark.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for asking me to talk. I just retired from a career in the National Park Service. I know I look young to retirements because I started at 4. So I've been a paramedic for about 34 years. I've been in law enforcement, firefighting, both structural and wildland, and I spent the bulk of my career at Grand Canyon National Park, which for reasons you'll see is an amazing venue for practicing the things that we've been talking about here all this week. So I'm going to concentrate on introducing you to some things about the application of high reliability. Why the heck would you become a ranger in the first place? My first exposure to anything you'd call a safety program or safety culture, I suppose, was back when I was a pretty young teenager, about 40 years ago. And I was working as a volunteer on a Forest Service trail crew. I shouldn't say Forest Service. I worked for an entity that serviced forests. And we built trails. And we had bosses. My boss was a guy that spent his whole career just moving heavy things around with mules, picks, and shovels. Wasn't really deep into the safety culture. But he'd gotten in tremendous trouble the previous year because there were unacceptable level of mostly minor injuries on his crew. But he solved the problem. You know how he solved it? The year I started, didn't report it. So we went from being the worst performing crew in the history of the trail crew to the best in such a short period of time. In fact, our slogan was, none of us get hurt twice before all of us get hurt once. It was that bad. But at the end of that next year, when we zeroed out our injury rate, or pretty much zeroed out because nothing was reported, they wanted to give us a safety award at the end of the season. So the entire crew, we looked like castaways. We hobbling up to the stage with eye patches and gangrenous wounds. And they presented each one of us with a safety award. You know what they gave us? Buck knives with the agency logo on it, which we immediately proceeded to lacerate and macerate each other. So I spent, I just retired as the chief ranger of the national park, that national park being Black Canyon, the Gunnison National Park, where I was for the past 5 years after coming there from Grand Canyon. It's only about 5 hours that way. It's a tremendous place. If you've never been there, you should see it. It's a hidden gem. But I spent my entire career both as a ranger and later as a supervisor and finally as a manager trying to figure out where are they, what are they doing. Because the rangers get lost into big empty spaces. So here's a quiz. Chief Ranger quiz for you. Find the ranger in this picture. Let me tell you a little bit about it. This is in Black Canyon, Gunnison. This is a climbing area for kind of the world's elite climbers. People don't come and climb at the Black Canyon unless they really got their stuff together. Things seldom go wrong there, but when they do, they go wrong in a huge way. And in this case, a very accomplished climber was on this wall the day before and was injured in a rock fall, and pretty badly injured. His buddy was able to lower him down to the bottom of the canyon and then hike back out of the canyon to get help. And so we got down there, spent the night with the guy, but then had to raise him out of the canyon. So in this picture, there is a 6-foot-tall ranger, a 6-foot-tall patient, and a 6.5-foot-long litter. Anybody seen it yet? I'll give you a general idea. It's kind of in here. Let me zoom in for you. Increase the light, I put an arrow. Can you see that dot next to the arrow? Let me zoom in a little bit more. There you go. There's your ranger, there's your litter, there's your arrows. As I started to work in supervisory management in national parks, like any other organization, always trying new things for safety and whatnot. And a lot of the things we tried were kind of off the shelf. Things that were kind of engineered for, were designed for like an engineered environment. And so we would get these questions and responses, and investigators would come and say, like, was the hazard marked? Had you identified the unstable and crooked surfaces? So we thought, well, we could get slurry bombers with black and yellow paint and just kind of fly the whole place and see if that worked. So crazy environments, a lot of these applications just didn't work for us. They're zooming back out again. The great thing about working in these environments is that things just don't go as planned. We didn't put together a whole bunch of construction and project managers and say, let's build the Grand Canyon, right? And some of the things that are used in industry, not necessarily applicable to us, but at the end of the day, I hope what I'm hoping you're going to see is that we are all much more similar than we are different. So whether we're talking about rangers at the end of the ropes, or we're talking about operators doing steam presses or running nuclear power plants, a lot of the challenges that we face are precisely the same. People just making errors, because we all make errors, it's just who we are. But look at this problem. No lockout tagout on the bear. Punish that guy. Let me tell you a little bit about Grand Canyon. It's such a busy place that it even has a book, a great book if you've never read it. It's not as dark as it sounds, but it's pretty dark. About 600 pages of death in Grand Canyon. There's been a lot of it. Why is this the busiest inland search and rescue venue in the world? Well, because 5 million people come there. And secondly, it's an upside down mountain. So every single day, people come to your national parks, Mount Rainier, Grand Teton, Denali, and they get out of their cars and they say, let's go climb that thing, right? And off they go. And what happens? They're climbing up and up, it's getting higher and colder and windier. And you think, this isn't fun. Let's buy a postcard of it and say we did it, right? Photoshop ourselves on the summit and go get a burger. And at that decision point, what do they have to do? Turn around, walk downhill. Everything's fine. Grand Canyon's totally different. It's like an antlion trap for humans. You stand up on the rim at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it is 65 degrees because you're at 6,500 feet. It's cool, it's gorgeous, the light's flat. You look down, you can see the river, it's right there. Who's been to the Grand Canyon? Okay, good. So you know how it feels. And you say, let's go to the river. And as you're walking, it's pretty easy, right? It's downhill. And then that chill of the morning starts to wear off. And then you're almost to the way to the bottom. You can hear the river now, except it's 120 degrees Fahrenheit. You get to the bottom. And you're like, yay, we made it. And you look back where your car is. So in a slow year, about 250 times a year, we would have to load up in our helicopter and go down there and rescue people. Busy year, closer to 500. Average year, 10 fatalities. Bad year, 22 or 23 fatalities. So a busy, busy place. So a really good venue to put into practice the things that we need to do to keep people safe and keep them coming home every day. So I want to talk about a little bit about that. I was blessed during my whole time previous to this to be familiarly acquainted through my wife with Todd Conklin. So for 25 years, I've been able to get free advice. If I had to go back and pay for that now, it would be a problem. But look at the variety of things and the skill sets that we ask of these people who work in your national park. This is what we would call a Thelma and Louise event. Following that movie, people like to drive into the Grand Canyon if they were having a bad day. This weird thing down here is actually about a 30,000 pound motor raft, a 30 foot long by 10 foot long raft from a really good and excellent long-standing company called Western River Expeditions. That rock right there has a name. It's called Big Red, and it's in Crystal Rapid. And if you go left of it or right of it, you're good. But if your motor stalls out and you end up on it, it's a bad day. Yellow Boat is an 18-foot ore boat raft that just kind of pulled you close to have a look. And so this was our version of Rush Hour. Bad things happen in national parks. I did not take this picture. This would be a really stupid place to stand. That's actually a training scenario at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center up in Glencoe, Georgia. All these park rangers, in addition to all of these other things that they have to do, they attend, you know, months and months of training at the Center of Excellence, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. I think of it more like a medium security junior college, but, you know, people don't think that these things happen. In my career, and I wasn't really looking for them, I've had to arrest and chase down murderers, kidnappers, rapists. I don't like that. My wife does. It's kind of her job. My enemy is mostly search and rescue. That's the stuff that I enjoy. So I'm going to read this. I'm going to talk about it for a second. We never send people off to get killed, but this is where we spend the next little bit of time. You ever heard that old Coast Guard credo, like you have to go, but you don't have to come back? You know, that ethic, which is, you know, not what we advertise, and we certainly don't send people out and say, put yourself in harm's way, take risks, live dangerously, and then, you know, try to make it back safely. We don't say that at all. We say, your job is to try your best to bring them home, the patient, the victim, the person who's scared, someone else's kid, whatever. And my job as the boss is to get you home. But people who go out to do these things that they really care about will take on amazing amounts of risk in trying to accomplish the task. And if we haven't done everything we possibly can to give them the capacity to deal with that job and to succeed, then we're not doing our job. So I'm going to tell you three stories. First one, we'll start off with the saddest one. We're going to talk about a tragedy, a near miss, and a miracle. All of them involving helicopters, and all of them involving people that I know. I think we can learn a lot from, you know, researching anecdotes and talking about them, but I've met, talked to, interacted with, in some cases, been very close friends with these people. So it's very meaningful to me. This is Nick Hall. Nick Hall is a U.S. Marine. When he finished his service with the Marine Corps, he became a climbing ranger at Mount Rainier because in his free time, he was an excellent mountaineer. I mean, just look at him. He looks like the kind of guy you would follow to and listen to, right? And he certainly had that bearing. I mean, he was a natural born leader, and that was matched with incredible confidence. Who's been to Mount Rainier National Park? Gorgeous, another gorgeous spot. Let me give you some Glacier 101. The thing about Mount Rainier, it's over 14,000 foot peak. It's covered in ice and snow. You don't get to see it too much if you're in Seattle because it's usually shrouded in clouds. But glaciers are big, moving sheets of ice, as we all know, and they have their own, you know, unique features like crevasses, big cracks that open up over time that you can fall down and just disappear into forever. They have their own, you know, almost rock formation made of ice, what's called serac. It's like a little pinnacle. There's Bergschrund, where it kind of interfaces with rock. So Nick Hall was the climbing ranger, seasonal, so not getting health benefits or anything else like that. They're very dedicated people. Working as peers with, not in a supervisory role, with the rest of the climbing rangers. They crack team of highly competent people who had summited this and other mountains, you know, all over the world. In 2012, Nick was killed on Mount Rainier. It was actually after a period of some pretty nice weather and a lot of people were attempting to summit, and there was a group of four people from Houston, Texas, and they had a mishap, and they ended up sliding a ways down the glacier, and a couple of them ended up down in the crevasse. So a bad day for those folks, for sure. So the climbing rangers, Nick Hall among them, started to respond to it. The incident kind of happened up here at about 13,700 feet, and as I'll show you in a minute, ended up way down here later. What was the task? This is one of the two more critically injured patients, abdominal muscle orthopedic injury. She'd taken a big fall down into the crevasse. So the first job was to get the climbing rangers up there. Some of the climbing rangers were already on the mountain, so they were able to access her and start to rig a rope system to pull her out of the crevasse, and they did that successfully with all of the people involved. Now it's a matter of getting these people off the mountain. So time pressures, time constraints, weather's changing. Actually, the weather at the time started off kind of pretty clear. It was forecast to get windy or nasty through the day. That's exactly what it did. Mount Rainier doesn't have enough of a rescue load. They have a dedicated helicopter because they're a right-side-up mountain, not an upside-down mountain. Grand Canyon, we had our own helicopter that we've used exclusively. So they worked closely with the Army. The Army, in their assessment of the weather conditions that were coming in and the fact that there were four patients in a narrow time window, chose wisely to send a big, heavy helicopter, Chinook, an aircraft that would be capable of hovering in place and loading all of the patients up into the belly of the helicopter by using a hoist, you know, or a winch cable that basically comes out of the belly of the helicopter. This is kind of the scene looking down the Emmons Glacier to 2,400 feet or so below. So they came in and they started the first hoist evolution. So the helicopter is hovering. According to the flight crew, these folks from the Army who were, you know, battle-proven and pretty darn good pilots, they said it was just everything they took they could do to keep that aircraft stable. They open up the belly, and they drop the cable out, and it's got an empty, break-apart litter, a litter that you've seen in your basket you carry people in. These are ultra-lightweight and break-apart because they're designed to be carried on a backpack. They had rigged up with that thing at the base of the mountain. They flew up. As soon as they dropped it down for that first evolution, the wind and the downdraft and the crosswinds coming started to whip that litter around the skids and was banging against the fuselage of the aircraft, so not a good situation. So Ranger Hall said, you know, I'm going to have a hard time controlling this litter. We need to put a tagline on it. Tagline idea being that they would attach a rope to the litter, drop the rope, Ranger could gather the rope, and then as it was lowered, it could kind of control that lowering. Essentially, hoisted up a couple of the patients using that tagline. When on the tragic evolution, what happened, Nick was trying to grab that litter. It's pretty aerodynamic and empty, and it's whipping around. The downwash from that aircraft when it's doing that full power hover, about 120 knots on the ground. 120 knots. So as Nick is struggling to grab the litter, he loses his balance and goes 2,400 feet down. Helicopter immediately chases him. Couldn't recover his body for almost 2 weeks because the weather did close in. It was done. So do you think there was an investigation afterwards? Absolutely. In the investigation, there's always pressure when something like this happens to produce an answer and show the public that you're doing something about it. And I think that the first iteration of the investigation was not the best. Because basically, what it did, and I think we've all seen this in our workplaces before, you blame the body. You know, you blame the individual actor, because we can look now and say, like, where was his ISACs? You know, ISACs, what you used, you know, to keep yourself from sliding down. Well, the ISACs was being used to secure his medical pack, otherwise the medical pack would go down. And there is no really written procedure for you've got two critical patients, two badly injured people, and they're spread out, and you need to move all these people under the 120 knot downwash. So it was like, well, did he choose to leave his ISACs there? We'll never know. But there were all kinds of problems. He failed to read and understand section 64B of the interagency helicopter operating guidelines. When the investigators come in with, you know, a dolly full of documents and policies and things like that, and find out, you know, which one did they not adhere to, in this case, which ones, many ones, did they not adhere to. The subsequent investigation did a much better job of looking at how did this happen. But talking to the surviving crew members and stuff like that, it became pretty clear that there were just some very glaring systemic errors going on at the park. Vital positions had been vacant and not filled for years. So who's responsible for making sure that they know about Section 68C of the IHOP? They didn't go out to get killed, they went out to save a life. But what happened is, we had a fatality. We blamed the body, we blamed the fatality on the person who was killed, and we came in later and actually figured out, like, well, you know, we can't hold them responsible for these things unless we give them the opportunity to learn. He knew everything he needed to know about helicopters, he knew everything he needed to know about rescue, but as the situation, there was nobody there to say, this is not how we're going to do business here. And so they were out there improvising. Everybody committed to get these poor people off the mountain before the weather came bad. Let's move on to some happier stuff. A near miss. This is going to take you to Arches and Canyonlands National Park near Moab, Utah. About 5 hours away, 6 hours away. Another gorgeous place. Who's been to Moab? Who's been to Canyonlands and Arches? Okay. Jeeping and mountain biking capital of the world. So tons and tons of that going on. They have an annual event called Jeep Safari. And during Jeep Safari, people come from all over the place to ride their Jeeps. And in this case, one of the Jeeps fell off of a sandstone fin, went down 60 feet, and ended up in this little ravine. These are members of the Grand County Search and Rescue Team, and they are quite accomplished, the busiest team in the state of Utah, so they work a lot and know what they're doing. And what they are doing here, you can see that cable. That cable is actually attached to the belly of the helicopter. It's called a short haul technique. And so this helicopter, and the ones I'm going to show you next, do not have a hoist, and so they can't pull these things up. The line is actually fixed to the helicopter, and the helicopter moves to move the line around. So they had two critical patients here, two pretty badly injured patients here, and the decision was made, you know, the quickest and best thing to do, all things considered, was to lift and up a helicopter. The first iteration, which is beginning here, went just fine. You can see there's the rescuer getting lifted out. Helicopter returned and did the next pick with the next patient. And now you notice we have an additional person hanging off the basket. That was not intentional. So this is going to be a story about performance modes. Jens Rasmussen, who talks about it, we're going to try to understand what, you know, what was going on to the operator at the time the thing happened. It's really helpful to understand what kind of mode they were in, you know, knowledge, rule-based. Or in this case, I'm going to talk to you about skill-based mode. The guy in the yellow helmet right there is named Vago Gearhart. Anybody ever seen Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom? Anybody ever seen Thelma and Louise? Have you ever seen the Taco Bell commercial where the guy falls off the cliff? Probably not. But Vago Gearhart is a professional. He was a Yosemite rock climber. He's in his 60s now. He's been there, done that. And when it comes to ropes, knots, carabiners, he's got it dialed. In fact, he works all over the world as a professional rigger, you know, rigging up ropes and things like that for special effects, movies, construction projects, etc. The reason he's hanging on to that litter with his strong forearms is because a piece of webbing with a knot that was hanging off of his harness, as he was about to step away from the litter and the pick was about to occur, kind of fell in and got stuck in just the flimsy metal, you know, between the frame and the top. And as the helicopter lifted up, he saw his stuff going tight, and boom, he's up in the air. Now the helicopter is overgross. It's got way more weight hanging underneath. This is a hot summer day. And off they go. It's a beautiful view, but that's not what the pilot intended, and that's not what anybody else intended. But getting back to performance mode, what do we do to fix this? Do we send Bago to make sure you're not accidentally tied into the litter training?
No.
Do we send him back to, here's how to tie a figure eight knot, and here's how not to tie a figure eight knot? Hell no. We go to the expert and say, what would you do to keep this from happening? And it was actually a pretty simple fix in this case. All these people were medically trained. If they're not medically trained, at least they've watched TV before. And so we just instituted a process. This common to, like, when you defibrillate a patient. I'm clear, you're clear, we're all clear. Taking an extra 5 seconds to make sure that there's no entanglement. There was already a really good practice for that, to make sure that the litter itself wasn't entangled to the ground, because tying a helicopter to the ground is not a good thing to do. So that we already do that as a practice. And we just added the step of just making sure that everybody was clear, nothing was dangling off, and in the prevention end, making sure that your harness was as clean as possible. So a lot of these folks, or myself included, would show up on incidents like this with our harnesses rigged for, you know, the rock climbing event or something else like that. and we would not necessarily reconfigure for a helicopter event. And we started doing that. So we can clean up all of our gear, have less things hanging off, and fix it that way. Now we'll talk about Miracle. This goes back to 1982. I'm happy to be in a crowd where most of you were born here in 1982. I teach wilderness medicine to people who are about 11 years old, it seems. And so all of my, when I say 1982, I'm like, yeah, well, Grandpa was riding a dinosaur around. Washington, D.C., United States Park Police, which is part of the National Park Service in D.C., and they have a helicopter called Eagle One, and Don Usher and Gene Windsor, Gene Windsor's out the door here, were on duty that day when Air Florida Flight 90 crashed into the Potomac, killing 73 people. Remember this? Dramatic video of the helicopter coming in and plucking the few remaining survivors out of the icy Potomac, right? Tool for the job? Probably not the most ideal tool for the job, but what was going on that day? Look at the other headlines. So it was a snow day, and in the federal government in Washington, D.C., if there's like 3/4 inch of snow, they send the whole federal government home, which is ironic if you're sitting in like Yosemite National Park or Yellowstone with 14 feet of snow out the window and you get an email from Washington, D.C. It's, go home early, there's 2 inches on the ground. You're like, okay, I'm going, no, you have to stay. So the entire federal workforce is leaving Washington, D.C., so the traffic is abysmal, right? Then there's an unscheduled subway train wreck with 3 fatalities that's pretty much tying up EMS and the ambulances as they're responding underground for that. And the Coast Guard rescue boat that works the Potomac was already called away on another mission. So the only asset that was getting to this crash was Eagle One, Don Usher, and Gene Windsor. Several people were killed on the bridge, too. They did miraculous things. They really did. Don Usher is not a cowboy. In fact, if you asked him, he would tell you he was a Maryland redneck. But he, that day, with Gene, improvised a life ring and a rope and tried to pluck those people out of the water. Couldn't, people are pretty much diminishing their capacity to grab onto the rope. In fact, one guy, one hero who perished in this, was helping other people, you know, grab the life ring until he himself finally ran out of energy and went underwater. But when you watch the video of this, and I'll save you the video because it never works for me, but in the video, they're dragging people across the ice, they're falling off again, and they're trying to get the ring to them again. Finally, they hover all the way down. The skids actually go into the water, into the slush, while Gene leans out and grabs a woman basically by her clothing and hangs her off the skid as Don crabs into shore, putting the main rotor disc like inches away from the faces of people who were standing. You know, one of the worst positions for helicopters to have the rotor disc up here and have people up here and moving that way. But if it went too high and the woman fell, she'd get hurt or back in the water. If it went too low, clipping these people up. So complete improvisation. Did they train for this? Did they have a procedure for this? Did they get in trouble for it? I don't know, they didn't get in trouble for it. In fact, that's where Eagle One's going to finally end up, as a law enforcement museum. They got citations from President Reagan. They got well-deserved Carnegie Award for heroism, and they were praised widely, just as the guy's arm and ear would have been if everything had gone smoothly. So it's important for us to understand, as I know we all do, preaching to the choir here, that defining success or failure depends almost entirely on how we look at it, how we look at the outcome. So how do I keep myself and my folks feeling safe? We're kind of fortunate. We have some advantages that some of these other folks I just talked about didn't. At the Grand Canyon, that's our dedicated helicopter. It's an MD-900 no-tail rotor. Do you notice it doesn't have a tail rotor back there? That's cheaper. So, no, actually, it's not cheaper. They bought this because it has quote-unquote quiet technology, because you don't want to disturb, you know, the Grand Canyon. It's a pretty important place to keep quiet. So it's a fantastic and capable aircraft. Twin engine, so one rotor step has 2 engines in it. So I felt pretty comfortable, and still do feel very comfortable with the capability of this aircraft. We would use this every single day. So, the longest we would go without having to fly into the canyon for some sort of emergency, it would be like 6 or 7 days. And then we're all just on fire because, we think whatever happens is really going to suck because it's going to be big because there's been all this built up, which is going to get us to the psychosis of being, you know, just kind of uneasy about how things are going all the time. So the capability of this kind of aircraft. Here's another short haul. This is me and a 18-year-old kid from Austin, Texas, who was close to the rim of the canyon, was, decided to take a shortcut, and then took a big rolling, tumbling fall, collapsed his lung, belly injuries, and things like that. And we were just going to pick him up. I got down to him on the ground, hiked into him. He's pretty critical. Lungs filling up with blood and stuff like that. And the idea was the helicopter's going to come in, we're going to hook up, and he's going to pick us up about 800 vertical feet and go about 200 meters lateral and put us down on the rim, get him in another helicopter, take him to the hospital. But instead, I ended up getting the dime tour of the Grand Canyon. So at this point, we're about a mile and a half off the rim, and I'm about 6,000 feet above the river, when that was not the plan at all. What caused us to take the scenic route? Condors. Yeah, California condors. There's only about 200 of them in the world. Severely endangered species, amazing birds, 9-foot wingspan. They're really cool looking, and they're curious. And so when they see the helicopter, they think, like, I think it's one of us. I don't know, seems kind of quiet. But doesn't have a tail rotor, can't be a helicopter. Let's go check it out. And so four condors just kind of show up. And I'm dangling down below there with this guy that, you know, my legs are falling asleep, hanging hard, so I want to get out of there. I'm talking to the pilot. I'm like, uh-oh, we've got big birds above. And the spotter looks up and says, oh my goodness. And so the pilot makes a very controlled turn out and over the canyon as we're climbing with the idea of just kind of outrunning the condors. But the condors would have nothing to do with it. They're like, you know, he wants to play. Let's go. So it was supposed to be like a 45-second, you know, 2-minute helicopter ride. Ends up being about 14 minutes. So hanging in that harness and looking down at the river and thinking, like, something goes wrong, there's time to, you know, we're both going to be like, this sucks, what do you think? I didn't Finally, we turned over the rim and landed where we were going to land at the helibase. And because we all live and work at the Grand Canyon, my daughter, who was about 4 at the time, was in the backyard with her babysitter. And the babysitter heard all the commotion and picked her up. I said, there's your dad. And she looked up and she said 2 things. Choking hazard. Just her, you know, word for anything dangerous. And then she said, isn't that cool? And my daughter went, why? Which I thought, that's a really good time to use why. We try to protect ourselves, inoculate ourselves as much as possible by really, really paying attention to operational learning. By assuming that, by just inculcating into ourselves and everybody that we work with, that every mission is going to be completely unique. No such thing as a routine mission. And that we were going to very mindfully discipline ourselves to brief in a thoughtful way on every incident. And every incident, that's a lot, you know, 300-400 times a year. We get kind of boring. We made little laminated cards. On the front was this stuff, you know, borrowed from Carl White. And whoever was the incident commander for the event, the person staying back behind the helibase would go through these things with the crew. They might have just done it 2 hours ago on another case, but we're going to pull that card out physically and do it again. And then be mindful that it's not going to be a robotic exercise, because we're going to pick something new out of the pre-brief, and we're going to learn a ton on the post-brief, even on the most simple of incidents. So the incident commander, here's what I think we face. This is my vision of what I think this operation is going to be. Here's what I came up with as far as what I want us to do. I think the things that can bias that we really need to pay attention to are as follows, and I want you to now talk to me. And modeling this behavior, especially as we brought in newer people or rookie people, you all know what it's like to be first day on the job or first month on the job, especially with a real high-performing group. You want to kind of keep to yourself. You don't really want to speak up a whole bunch, and we would trap these people. Sometimes we would come up with stupid ideas here to see if they would call us on it. Because we tell them ahead of time, we expect you to call us on this stuff. And as they realized that was the game, they realized also, like, hey, in a couple of years, I can play the game with people. So it kind of kept it fresh, right? So we'd have some good conversations. Now, this seems like, doesn't take very long. And these are emergency circumstances. And, you know, when we watch TV, it's like, when seconds count. You know? And so my mantra, you know, after starting off in emergency vehicles, ambulances, and city streets, where people get killed and run over by fire trucks, ambulances, and police cars, and in my, you know, 30-plus years as a paramedic, I can probably count on half a finger the number of people who would have, you know, not survived had we gotten there, or would have survived if we got there just 5 seconds earlier. It's just not that way. So our mantra was, when seconds count, slow down. because that's when you really need to be thinking about what you're going to do here. So we go do the good thing, and then we come back and have our debrief up at the side of the card. You know, when you talk about after-action reviews, we would certainly elevate these things. If we really felt that the information we were getting on the hot debrief or something went completely haywire, or there was some really rich learning to happen after that event, then we would have a formal after-action review. And we would bring in everybody in the overhead and all the people involved and talk about it. But if you only do that for the big events, even for the big events, it's hard. Can we do it Monday? Can't Monday. I got a wedding. How about Tuesday? Tuesday. No, I'm not honeymoon. Oh, you're getting married. Congratulations. And so you can never get everybody there all at the same time. And you missed on the opportunity to get these nuggets that you can communicate out creatively in any way you want. So when people come back, what was our mental vision? We have that great facility in our brains to run simulations. And that's all we're doing is we approach these things. Just like you when you go to the grocery store. You know, they're running a simulation. I want tomatoes, milk, things like that. So how did this differ from our simulation? What did we learn from it? And then be quiet and listen a little bit. Pause. You know, there's nothing to get people talking more than one. Filling up some silence, right? So if you're leading one of these things, ask the question and then look like you want an answer. People will make crap up all the time, but you're also going to get some really good information when there's information. And then what should we change? And then really the follow-up question to that is it's the incident commander's responsibility to make sure that information about what we're going to change, like, hey, we're going to do a step back, and I'm clear, you're clear, we're all clear before we lift that litter to make sure we're not entangled into it. We need to share this with everybody we possibly can. And some just general overarching operating principles that we try to stick to and review. No such thing as a routine call. Every call is different. In fact, a lot of what we responded to were just red dots, red dot incidents. The technology available to people now is you can take a panic button into the backcountry with you, right? And if anything goes wrong and you need help, what do you have to do? Push the button. It talks to a satellite. It either goes to us or the Russians. The Russians are still friendly enough to call us if they get one. And what you get is a red dot on a map. Could be anything. Could be a guy with diarrhea, as it often is. Could be somebody who decided that their camping trip is no longer fun. Happens too. Could be somebody who wants a helicopter rescue because they think the water tastes funny and they might get diarrhea and might not have fun. Or it could be life-threatening, you just don't know. So you're going off into the unknown on almost every single one of these things. So, no such thing as a routine call. We're going to maintain a healthy sense of unease. That cone that you were showing just a few minutes ago, the previous speaker, I'm sorry, your name just flew off.
Brian.
Yeah, that great cone. I was looking at the cone and I was like, our cone is like, whatever it is, it's going to be scary, it's going to suck, and we're probably going to ball it up. So let's really plan it hard so we can get it right when it actually happens. You know, so this healthy sense of unease or pessimism, never laying back and saying like, we got this, we've done this 10,000 times before, because that, I fear, gets us hurt. There's too much at stake to be mindless. We can't just, you know, we've got to be physically ready, we've got to be mentally ready, we have to be rested, and those are all hard things to do when you work, as we all know, when you have, you know, staff constraints, budgetary constraints, things like that. You don't always get a fresh and happy group of people who don't have anything else in their lives going on. And that every operation demands that we respect each other, but not at the expense of keeping your thoughts to yourself if they're important thoughts. And that extends to the people in more leadership role and the more senior people on the team to prod the more junior people to tell us, you know, where we get it wrong, because that's the only thing that's going to keep us safe. Oh, that cool helicopter? That's it. 4 days after that picture of me hanging from it, 4 days later, only like a little less than 1.3 hours of flight time after that last short haul, this happened. What normally causes, when you see a balled up aircraft, by the way, the FAA and NTSB, you know what they call this? A hard landing. I got State Farm, but if I called and I said, hey, I had a hard parallel parking. Are you going to drive home? My car's in four pieces, but it's, you know, not total. So this is a hard landing. And every time you see an aircraft in pieces on the ground, what do you think? I mean, and truly, what usually causes it? What was the soft point system that caused that aircraft to end up in pieces on the ground? Usually pilot error or something. The point being, to spend another 3 days talking about pilot error. The point being is the one we very seldom hear about that's hardly even appreciated, mechanical failure. Mechanical failure is so darn rare. in these kinds of aircraft. But that's exactly what happened here. That NOTAR system, the system that, you know, instead of having a tail rotor, it basically has like a jet ski thing that kind of spins around and blows air out in different directions. It's controlled by the pedals of the aircraft. It's controlled by, you know, physical medical cables. And those cables come together in this tube, and they're hooked to the pedals, just, you know, simple mechanics. And they're in an area that's in that empennage that doesn't even get physically, or now it does, but wasn't even subject to annual physical inspection. So when they would tear the aircraft apart annually, it was a part that was felt to be so, you know, so reliable that it doesn't even need to be inspected on any particular schedule until it snapped. And when it snapped, the pilot, Borden Miller, fantastic guy, lost all rotor authority. And if you don't have, or all pedal authority, so if you don't have the pedals and something to counteract, then the aircraft begins to do what? It's just a spinning top on this big blade with nothing to counteract, and so that's what's happening. This is on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. See, there are lots of trees. In fact, there's a ton of trees on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. There's more trees than there's not trees, and so they're clearing. And so our operating guidelines when using the aircraft in that kind of environment is to make sure that we were always trying to keep some altitude so that if something went wrong unexpectedly, we'd have a little bit of altitude to work with to get safely to the ground, hopefully to a soft spot. There were six people aboard this aircraft when that happened. Borden got it into the ground, recognizing that he wasn't going to be able to control it. He did as best he could by doing power plays just in a few seconds. This all happened in about 7 seconds. You know, from the time he was making a nice controlled approach to land until the time everything went haywire. But he recognized, I got to do everything I possibly can because of his training and his mental checklist for when things go wrong to disperse the energy that they were going to absorb. So he used every little last ounce of control that he had to crash that aircraft in a safe way. That's capacity. That's capacity by practice. That's capacity of having a skilled pilot in a procedure who's run through it in his or her head a million times. And has kind of visualized what they're going to do when this happens. So we had capacity by the practice of the pilot. But we also had capacity by design. The seats in this aircraft are designed to survive a crash or to help you survive a crash. They're on rails, and when you take the impact, they have friction fittings, and they kind of collapse. You know, just like we were talking about the Volvo, you can't get killed in. I'm waiting for the helicopter, you can't get killed in. The Volvo needs to start making helicopters. Right? It's a big airbag with a rotor on top. The shape of the aircraft itself. If I had to say, what basically is that shape? It's kind of an egg. When you look at the aircraft, I went back to the old slide, you see it's sort of like an egg. Why the egg shape? Why did they design that egg? Because some brilliant engineer who was like between jobs watched the hen lay eggs and thought, isn't it amazing the way that thing doesn't just explode out into scrambled eggs? Right? It's because the shape gives it strength. So as the aircraft was destroying itself on the ground, the actual design shape of the aircraft gave us the capacity to make this a survivable injury. So what I've tried to talk about is the fact that when things go poorly, it's really easy to go and blame the operators, the people very, very close to the incident, the last person who touched it, and say, like, God, I never would have done that. And it must have been so obvious to them that they were doing something wrong, and we're just going to go out and tell everybody not to do that, right? Or, in the case of the near miss, that if we understand what performance mode the operator was in, we can find a collaborative fix to make it safer going forward. And three, in the miracle, the fact that if you break every rule in the book, but it works, it's hard to come in critically later and say, that sucked, you saved those people and didn't damage the aircraft and got on national TV. You know, who wants to come in and punish them? I mean, the president was happy with it, right? And they didn't want to be punished either, you know. But I talked to Don Usher, and of course he said, I said, of course, you know, I'd do it again. He said, but when they landed and he realized how much ice he had picked up on that aircraft, that it kind of haunted him, that he was moments away. If there was one more person in the water that he went for, that tail rotor was going to quit working. He was going to go down too. So very, very, very close. And so it's our retrospective understanding to tell us whether it was good or not. And that if all else fails, and all else will fail eventually, no matter what you do, you got to count on capacity and practice and design to save it. It's been an absolute pleasure talking.
That was Mark Yeston. What do you think? Oh, my goodness. You know, Mark is the one. Do you remember the podcast he did earlier where he said, I have to be with my guys when they're successful, so I earn the right to be with them when they fail? Same guy. Amazing set of stories. I thought it was remarkable that he went all the way from Rasmussen to Capacity and sort of everywhere in between in those three stunning stories. That's the podcast for today. Sorry for the extra time, but I think it's worth it. I bet you listened. Until then, I hope you get to learn something new every single day. For goodness sakes, have as much fun as you possibly can. And please be safe.